Hey, good evening. Good. We see some new faces here this week. That's great. Well, the way I'd like to start off tonight is I know you guys said it's some homework, and I'd like to start off with some like comments or questions that you may have had from the homework. I'm not going to open it up to complaints because I know we would probably have a lot of hands raised then. But comments or questions, what did you experience through the homework? How was it, you know, maybe reading the book of Revelation with no chapters and verse divisions and different things like that? Yes. Go ahead.
I did it this afternoon.
Okay.
So I was in a little bit of a rush.
Okay.
But I did like the continuity of it, and I really liked it. It was definitely a bring you up and then bring you back down sort of thing. I like that it it started off very I don't know, great introduction, great time, great end. But I guess the thing that I liked most about it was that it was like the warmest and kindest at the beginning and end.
Hmm.
And then in the middle was where it was, you know, very, I guess, dreamlike.
And, that's interesting. In a couple of weeks, we'll come back to that because we'll be talking about structure. So that's interesting how there's almost like a bracket or a bookend around the book that, that's interesting. What else? Any questions or anything that may have come up? You have a question or comment?
I just comment about the contrast between D-Day and V-Day.
Yeah, that's a very I love that picture of the Normandy and stuff like that, and how we have already won the battle, but the victory isn't consummated until V-Day. Yeah, we're living in between the already and the not yet. That's a very important concept throughout the whole New Testament, especially. Very important that we do experience some of the blessings that we will experience in the fullness whenever Christ comes a second time. What else? Good stuff. Any questions or anything that maybe wasn't clear in the readings or anything like that? Yes.
Yeah, the hat you was wearing in that picture was wrong backwards.
Yeah, I was asking my brother if he's referring to the newspaper article. I said that's not vain, right? I said it's a really good article. I wasn't doing it for the picture. I really wasn't. I really hope that article kind of was a good introduction. Yes, the hat. Matter of fact, this is interesting. I'll tell you a little story. The reason why that picture actually even made it in the newspaper is because they came into seminary. That's whenever I had hair down about here a couple of weeks ago. And they came in there and they were surprised to see hippies going to the seminary. I was like, well, I wouldn't claim to be a hippie, but whatever works, I guess. Anything else? Any other questions or comments about my attire or anything else? Okay. Last week we went through we started off going through the introduction. I kind of talked about the different perspectives on the book of Revelation. Some people ignore it. Some people are obsessed with it. And my attitude toward the book of Revelation is that I want us to not ignore it, nor be obsessed with it, but to be transformed by it. And that, to me, is a different attitude, a different drive than what we see common and in the common religious society at large. Because we either flat out ignore it, nobody ever talks about it, or that's all they ever talk about. And it needs to be somewhere more in the middle. And I also talked about last week about my approach, about how the principle of humility and the principle of submission and the principle of context. Remember that big catchword that I was hammering last week, and we will hammer for the next 9 weeks. Context, context, context. Why is context so important? Why is it?
Tells the whole story.
Yes. It tells us. I mean, if you don't have context, then you can do whatever you want with whatever words are on the page. I use this example. It's not even a good example, but it just proves the point that I can take the word calendar and I can create a whole cult out of the word calendar. I can pull it away and I can say that actually that word spells out this ancient god, that I am in the form of that god and my name is Kalendar. I'll just pronounce it different. And then I can create it. But people do this. This is what people do with words and with phrases. And I talked about last week how I can take four passages from the Bible, string them together, and prove to you that you need to do something not very uplifting. And the way I did it was I said, Judas went out and hung himself. Therefore, go and do likewise. And what you're going to do, do quickly. See, if those are all Bible passages, but I've taken them all out of context. And if I take them out of context, I can do whatever I want. Right? So our goal in Bible study is to read the words that are found in the Bible in the original context. And then we will be able to apply it to our lives. But we've got to do this first step first. Otherwise, it's chaos. There's as many interpretations then as there are people. Does that make sense? Okay. And then we started talking about... we started defining some of the terms that get tossed around a lot in the Revelation discourse. The first one we talked about was the literal versus figurative debate. And basically what I proposed was that instead of trying to read the book of Revelation literally or figuratively, we need to read it naturally. And there's a big difference. Because literally, if I am literally saying something as a symbol, then you need to literally interpret it as a symbol. Does that make sense? The example I used last week was that you are driving me crazy. Now, literalistic, the interpretation would be that you're putting me in a vehicle and you are driving me to a place that is called crazy. But that's not what I'm really meaning whenever I'm saying that, is it? I am meaning that you are annoying me, right? Does that make sense? So you need to understand or interpret what I am saying naturally. And the natural interpretation of it may be a symbol. Are we all following me right now? Does that make sense? In other words, let the author say what the author is trying to say. Does that make sense? I'm seeing some heads nod, some confusion. I know I'm going through this quick, but you can get the notes if I'm confusing you. Then we talked about the phrase last days. And how did we see the Bible defining the words last days through the passages we looked at? Yes. The time period between the first coming and the second coming. And that's a radically different definition than what we function off of today. Because a lot of times when people say the words last days, what do they usually mean? The couple days right before everything ends. Or right before the tribulation begins. That's what usually people are talking about. Problem is, all six times that it's used, last days or last times is used once, in the New Testament, it isn't talking about the couple days before the tribulation or the end. It's talking about from the moment that Jesus came here until He comes again. In context, that's what those six passages mean. And so we said, if we're going to allow the Bible to transform us instead of us transforming the Bible, then that's the definition we should submit to as well. You following me so far? Okay. Now, we're going to finish up last week's lecture, because we're on page 7 of the first week's handout. Page 7. And I want to be, and actually it's only the bottom two lines of page 7, so you can flip to page 8 if you want. But we're going to be defining what is prophecy. What is prophecy? Because when you're talking about the book of Revelation, that is the huge word that always comes up, doesn't it? And here's my problem, is that we use the word prophecy so much, but we never even ask the question, what does it mean? We don't ask it. We just assume that we know it, don't we? I'm not going to ask you what your definition of it is yet. I'm not going to put anybody on the spot. What I want to do is this. I've taken four different sections of society, and I have listed different examples of the way in which they define prophecy. And then I want to ask the question, after those four sections of society, how does the Bible define the word prophecy? But you know, this concept is pervasive in our society, is it not? You can prove this really easily, and I did this a couple weeks ago. If you type in the word prophecy into Google, you will get over 20 million websites that are related to this word. Our society is a little bit interested in this concept. They want to know what prophecy is. And so the first thing I want to look at is the doomsday cults. We've all heard about these phenomenons from here and there throughout the news history or whatever, I don't even know, throughout something. But the first one I want to talk about is in 1993. There was a man by the name of Vernon Howell who began preaching to a sect of the Seventh-day Adventists. And he described his teaching as the revelation of the sealed scroll in Revelation chapter 5. He said that he was the foretold lamb of Revelation chapter 5. You know, the slain lamb that has the power to open the scroll? He says that was me. And as a result, Vernon Howell said, I am heir then to David's throne. And that's why he renamed himself David Koresh. And what David Koresh then began to do is he began teaching the branch Davidians that the coming Armageddon was about to happen. That Armageddon was about to occur. And as you all know, in 1993, compound. Thank you. I was thinking convent, and I knew that wasn't right. I didn't know where to go from there, though. Thank you. At their compound in Waco, Texas, they had their own Armageddon. Problem was, it didn't spread into a worldwide battle. It ended up with the killing of almost all of their lives. But this is the question I'm asking, though. How has he defined prophecy? Keep that in mind. We're going to keep going. You also have March 23rd, 1997. A man by the name of Marshall Applewhite convinced 39 men and women. He basically convinced them of a teaching of prophecy. But the problem was, is none of them were asking the question, what is prophecy? And what he ended up teaching them was, is that the Bible had revealed that there was a comet coming by, and it was a UFO spaceship that was in it or behind it, and that if they would kill themselves, they would be the martyrs talked about in Revelation that would be immediately transferred up to heaven's gates, which is where they got their name. And so, 39 men and women, on March 23rd, 1997, killed all their lives, thinking they would be immediately transferred to this UFO. How has he defined prophecy? Because it sounds an awful lot like the way David Koresh defined it. But we'll get to that in a bit. March 17th, 2007, 924 people were convinced of the prophetic messages that they were supposed to burn themselves alive in Uganda. And they did. Late 1980s, a man by the name of Jeffrey Lundgren killed a family of five based off his interpretation of biblical prophecy. Not to mention the late 1970s, whenever a man by the name of Jim Jones convinced 914 people to kill themselves based off what? His definition of prophecy. See, all of these cults have something in common, is they have the same definition of the word prophecy. But what you're going to notice is that even the secular culture has the same definition. The secular culture is obsessed with at least two areas of prophecy. Number one, you have the horoscopes. It's this section of the newspaper that people... That's actually one of, if not the most popular section of the newspaper. Because people are obsessed with hearing these little prophetic words spoken into their lives. They define prophecy the same way as the cults do. But not only that, we also have these psychics. You know, we've turned people like Miss Cleo into millionaires off of our definition of prophecy. Why do people call Miss Cleo or people like her? What's that? They want to know the future. They want to know their good fortunes or misfortunes so that maybe they can, well, I don't know, maybe they can dodge them or maybe they can grab a hold of them. I don't know. The point is, they're still functioning off the same definition of prophecy as the doomsday cults. Same definition. Let's move now, though, a little bit closer to home. The Christian community at large defines prophecy, I'm going to suggest, in the exact same way as the two previous sections. I've got this book, I showed it last week, Charting the End Times. This is how we define prophecy. What we do with prophecy is we make maps. And what is this a map of? How the world's going to end. That's what it is. This is how we define prophecy. The same thing is found in, have you ever read or heard of the book The Late Great Planet Earth? Hal Lindsey, in 1974, is when it, you know, that decade of the 70s, it actually sold more copies than the Bible in that decade. It's a pretty popular book. Interestingly enough, he's had to revise it because you see his key prophecy in the book was that the world was going to, that Jesus would come back, the second coming was going to occur in 1988. Do you know where he gets that number? What happened in 1948? Israel became a nation. See, and based off of Matthew 24, they said that one generation later was whenever Jesus would come back and establish His kingdom. And scholars, this is a truth like across the scholarship, is that a generation is about 40 years. That's just what all scholars believe. And so, 1948 plus 40 years equals 1988. Well, we're in 2008. We have a problem. But this is interesting because because Tim LaHaye also supported this prophecy. But whenever it didn't happen, they did something interesting. They said, well, a generation can also mean anywhere from 40 to 120 years, which would put LaHaye, or would put Hal Lindsey at 139 and LaHaye at 142 years old. So I guess it'd be hard to tell them they're wrong twice. But then you also have Edgar Wisenot, who published a book called 88 Reasons Why the Rapture Will Happen or Will Occur in 1988. You have Pat Robinson, who predicted the end of the world would happen in 1982. And I want to point out something really quick. Yes?
Quick question. Is Tim LaHaye one of the authors of the Left Behind
Yes, he is. Tim LaHaye and Jim Jenkins are the Left Behind series authors. I want to point out, though, on page 9, why I get so excited or impassioned at this point is because that website up at the top is a website created by a non-Christian that lists every single time and documents every single time that a Christian has made a prophecy and it hasn't come true. Did you catch that? This is a non-Christian. And we're going to talk about why that's important here in a minute. I want to also... But my point is this, though. What is their definition of prophecy? Do you see what I'm saying? Are you drawing the lines? Are you connecting the dots? The same definition of prophecy from the doomsday cults is the same definition of the secular culture at large, which is the same definition of the Christian culture at hand. Now, we also have other faith-based communities. I don't know why I wrote 19th century under Jehovah's Witnesses. It's supposed to be 20th. Because if you look at my first date, it's 1914, so I'm not sure what I was thinking there. But they believe that the Jehovah's Witnesses... Now, this is interesting, actually. Jehovah's Witnesses teach, or taught, that Armageddon would happen in 1914, and that Jesus would come and establish His kingdom on earth. And when it didn't happen, do you know what they said happened instead? They said, oh no, He came back. Only the elect can see Him, though. He's invisible. But now catch this. This may be able to, this for me connected some dots. What the way Jesus now is ruling is He is the voice, the invisible force behind what they call the watchtower. And this is why whenever you're dialoguing with a Jehovah's Witness and you say, yeah, but what does the Bible say about that? Their response would be, who cares? The watchtower says this. And to us, that's just horrendous. But for them, if Jesus did come back in 1914 and establish the watchtower, and He is speaking through it today, why wouldn't you listen to the watchtower? You see their logic. It makes sense. Here's my problem, though. The Watchtower taught that in 1975 we would be experiencing the 6,000th anniversary of Adam's creation. And they got it through a bunch of scientific methods. But if it's Jesus talking, who cares, right? I don't care how they got it if it's Jesus talking. The reasoning behind this, though, I will explain this, is that 1,000 years they believe would pass for each day of creation. And at the seventh day, or the seventh millennium, would be the millennium of peace talked about in Revelation 20. And they believe that would occur in 1975. Problem is, we're in 2008. Do you see the problem? We're in 2008! What? Is that what whispering was for before? Okay. Whatever. I'm further ahead. You know what I'm saying. The point is we're in 2007. This is recorded. That's wonderful. I don't even know where I'm at anymore. My wife has to tell me how old I am. We're in 2007. I was wondering what the hisses were for. I was trying to figure that out. And it's 7, but I was just hearing boos and hisses. I figured, wow, this is what the prophets must have felt like. Okay, anyway. The point is that we're in 2007. We're at least 22 years or 32 years removed from this prophecy. Not to mention the Watchtower has predicted that the world would end or the millennium would begin in 1914, 1915, 1918, 1920, 1925, 1941, 1975, and 1994. Now, if this is Jesus talking, do you see my problem? However, how are they defining the word prophecy? Do you catch that? It's the same way as the other three groups before them. They're doing the same thing. They're looking at prophecy the exact same way. And I won't leave out the Mormons. Mormonism defines prophecy the same way as well. As a matter of fact, Joseph Smith was praying earnestly one time because he wanted to know when the Son of Man would come back. And he said, this is what he said. He said he received this voice, and the voice said this, Joseph, my son, if thou livest until thou art 85 years old, thou shalt see the face of the Son of Man. Therefore, let this suffice, and trouble me no more on this matter. And Joseph Smith then said, I was left thus without being able to decide whether this coming referred to the beginning of the millennium or to some previous appearing, or whether I should die and thus see His face. I believe the coming of the Son of Man will not be any sooner than that time. Joseph Smith decided to make this crystal clear on February 14th, 1835, whenever they got together for a meeting, and he said, that Jesus would return in 56 years. Well, Joseph Smith died on June 27th, 1844, at the age of 38, and was fairly shy of his 85th birthday. But my question, once again, it's not to critique these positions. My question is to ask, how are they all defining prophecy? Now I'm looking for an answer. How are they defining prophecy?
Foretelling
the future. It's prediction. That's what they're defining it as, correct? Isn't that the way that we define it? I know I'm not looking for head nods because I don't want to put... I know you guys think he's going to pull a punch on me. No, but that's the way I defined it all my life. That's the way I was taught growing up. That's the way I've believed all my life. But here's my question. More than I want to know what the doomsday cults believe, or what the secular culture believes, or even the Christian culture, or even other faith-based communities, what I want to know is, how does the Bible define the word prophecy? Because once again, that's more important to me. No offense, it's not that I don't appreciate you or anything along that matter, but my question is, not how you define it, but how does the Bible define it?
Doesn't it give you more what than when?
What do you mean?
It tells you what's going to happen, not when it's going to happen.
Okay. Okay, yeah. What you're getting at is what I want to get at, and that's this. What is the essence of prophecy? What would be the point if it's strictly prediction? And we're going to get into that. What I want to do is this, really quick. Is I want to talk about the dangers of the definition of prophecy as prophecy equaling prediction. Here are the dangers. Number one, Jesus hasn't come back yet. And so there is one thing that all four of these sections of society have in common, and that's that every one of their prophecies have not come true. they're at least all consistent in that, is that they get all their prophecies about when Jesus was going to come back, at least this far, they're all wrong. But the problem is what happens on number three, is how that damages our Christian witness. I've already talked about that entire website that is dedicated to documenting Christians making a fool of themselves, saying, oh yeah, Jesus is coming back. And here's how their logic is. Well, if they're wrong about the second coming, they're probably wrong about His first coming. I mean, if they can't get this right, how can I expect them to get this right? Oh, sure, He's God. What if you get that prediction wrong? Do you see the logic? Do you see how this kind of irresponsibility damages the gospel? It flat out makes it a mockery. Oh yeah, God knows everything, but His people can't get it right. How does the Bible talk about people that make prophecies that don't come true? And what does the Old Testament say we should do to them? I'm not suggesting we do this. What's that? Stone them. Now, why would the Old Testament say something like that?
Because it's taken very seriously.
Exactly. This is not something that they toy around with. Why? Because the false prophecies directly reflect upon the one in which they're speaking for.
In other words, if you're going to say something, you better make sure that you've got it straight from God.
Exactly. If you're going to be speaking for God, make sure it's God speaking. here's another problem.
Shane.
Yes?
I do remember one time that Pat Robertson was interviewed after he made a prediction, mm-hmm. and it did not come true. And he said, predictions are no more than us trying to take documented facts and bring it into the future and talk about it. If it doesn't happen, that doesn't mean it won't happen. And he said, if I've done nothing else, I have led more people to Christ through the fear that the end times was going to happen now. I heard him say that.
So the end's just...
I'm not going to respond to that.
I know. And it goes to Scripture that God says He can use anybody...
Yes, He can.
...to accomplish His person, or His reasons for His whatever He wanted to do. People who aren't even godly.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he can. Yes, he can. But still, I come back to my question. Is, to me, what's important is not Pat Robertson's excuses. It's the Bible's definition of prophecy. There is an interesting biblical precedent for prophecies or the second coming of Christ. If you flip to Matthew 24:36, does anybody know what this says off the top of their head? What is Matthew 24? Does anybody know what Matthew 24 is? Olivet Discourse. This is a huge prophetic chapter. Well, a huge... hold on. It's a huge chapter for those obsessed with prophecy. Let me put it that way. Matthew 24, verse 36 says this. No one knows about the day or the hour. Now, what day or hour is he talking about? The second coming, the end of the world. No one knows about that day or hour, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. And yet, you see my problem. Well, what about 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 3? Because I think this one actually is more interesting. Not that the words that Jesus says aren't interesting. It's not what I'm saying. Although I think that, you know, the fact that it's in red letters should carry a little bit more weight. 1 Thessalonians 5, 1 through 3 says this, though. Now, brothers, about times and dates, we do not need to write to you. Is it because they already know? No. What does he go on to say? He says, verse 2, he says, for you know very well that the day of the Lord will come like a thief in the night. We'll talk about that in a second. While in verse 3 it says, while people are saying peace and security, destruction will come on them suddenly as labor pains on a pregnant woman, and they will not escape. Now Paul uses two distinct metaphors when he's talking about the second coming of Christ here. The first one is a thief in the night. Now here's my question. If you knew that a thief was coming to your house at 7:30 tonight, where would you be? At home. Exactly. You're going to be there waiting for the thief to come so that you can protect your house, right? But how often does the thief schedule a break-in with you? It doesn't happen very often, does it? If you know one, let me know. I'd like him to rob my house. It'd make things a lot easier. The point is this, is that thieves are not easily documented. They come unexpectedly. They come when you least know it. The point is that whenever you need to always be prepared in case a thief comes. And Paul says the second coming will be like a thief in the night. It's unexpected. You just need to be prepared at all times. In case he comes now. Remember we talked about last week. There is nothing standing between now and eternity. It could happen at any moment. And the way you need to live your life is constantly with two words in your mind, and that is perhaps today. That's what Paul is saying. He's saying, no, it's like a thief. And he also uses another metaphor, though. He talks about it being like a woman in labor pains. Now, there's one thing, when a woman starts having labor pains, that I've heard happen before. My wife hasn't done this, but I've heard happen before that it's interesting. They'll start feeling the pains, and they'll realize it's a lot worse than what they thought it was going to be. And they'll say, I'm not doing this. I'm not doing it. I don't care. It's not happening. But when a woman starts having labor pains, there's one thing you know. The baby's coming. There's really not many choices. It's inevitable. It's going to happen. And Paul says the second coming is like the labor pains of a woman that is pregnant. It's going to happen. It's going to happen. There's no question about it. Jesus is coming back. So whenever you put those two together, what's he saying? It is going to happen, so you better be ready. Does that make sense? Yes?
Well, you know you're going to have the baby, but you don't know when.
Mm-hmm.
That's the thing. Your labor can be, 4 hours, or for some women, it could be 30.
Yes, and the bottom line of those two metaphors, though, it's so powerful, is the inevitability of the second coming and the unexpectedness of the second coming. And that for me, bucks up against this definition of prophecy equaling prediction. It is the biblical precedent of the second coming or the end of the world is that it is unexpected, but it will happen. Right? Does that make sense? Okay, we're going to keep developing this. Well, we'll flip the page. It says 23, but I believe it is 23. That's right. I got that page number right. At the bottom half of the journal or of the newspaper article you're supposed to read, there's another article. But if you look on the far right side, there's numbers. And it's Dr. Lowry is being interviewed by Steve Arney. And Lowry starts giving, he gives 10 different reasons why setting dates is so dangerous. The first one is this. It can ruin a believer's faith when the prophecy fails to come to pass. Do you see the danger there? It's not just about Christian witness. It can also be a danger to us. Whenever we're making these predictions, we think are from God and they don't happen. It can damage your faith. Number two, it can ruin a teacher's reputation when the prophecy fails. You know, this is something that we need to be held accountable more to in the Christian society. Because the same people that were making these predictions about 1982 and 1988 are still considered prophetic experts. And that blows my mind. I'm like, if you fail at the one thing you're considered an expert, can I call you an expert anymore? But we let them slide. We still listen to them. We still buy their books. We still are like, oh, well, you see my problem. If they're getting it wrong, then they need to repent instead of making excuses. Now, I'm starting to get in a little bit of a response to the Pat Robertson thing, but they need to repent, not excuse themselves. Don't get me wrong, whenever in Philippians, when Paul's talking about, whenever people from Philippi write to Paul and they say, this guy's not preaching the right gospel, and what does Paul say? Well, as long as the gospel's being preached. But Paul doesn't say that guy's still okay. Paul says, well, I'm glad the gospel's being preached, but don't get me wrong, I'll start praying against that guy probably. I want him to, quote unquote, shut up, to keep his mouth quiet, because he's doing damage to the gospel. In other words, what I'm saying is, I know we're infallible, or I know we're not infallible. I know we're not. I know that we make mistakes. But we'll get to there. Hold on. I'm not gonna finish that. I'm getting off track. Number three, it makes a mockery of the Christian faith when the prophecy fails. That should be a concern to us as well. You are a Christian. And if this is reflecting on Christianity, it makes you look like a fool as well. Number four, it can turn a person away from the Christian faith if the Christians don't get it right. And this was interesting. Last night, I didn't realize Lowry had said the same thing. I was like, well, I must have heard it from him. If Christians don't get it right about the second coming, how can they get it right about the first? Number five, it can keep believers from planning for the future. In other words, why do I need to worry about 1989 if it's going to end in 1988? The doomsday cults did the same thing. A lot of them, they sell all their possessions because it's all going to end, right? There could be a danger in that. Number six, can lead to destructive behavior, wishing for World War III. This is fascinating. It does not seem Jesus-like to me to get giddy whenever conflicts start in the Middle East. People are going to die that don't know Jesus, and that gets me excited. You see my problem with that? We're going to talk about Armageddon in a couple weeks and how that's been about as misconstrued as prophecy. Number seven, it can lead to indifference concerning social problems. Number eight, can lead to deception when the prophecy fails. Yes. Number nine, it wastes the believer's time. And number 10, has not been successfully predicted thus far. So now I'm coming to... Do you understand that... Have I made my case of how dangerous it can be to define prophecy as strictly prediction? Does that make sense? It can... I think I've made my point. I'm seeing nods. I'll move on. So, let's look at what the Bible defines prophecy as. If you look on... And it says 16 through 20, but it actually is 17 through 21... You have a handy-dandy chart. Now, this is not homework, so don't gasp or anything like that. But what I've done is if you want to do further study, or if you want to prove that what I'm saying is right or wrong, what I've done is I've listed every single time in the English that the words prophecy, prophesy, or to prophesy occur in the Bible. Every single time in the English they occur. They're all listed over here where it says text. And what I've done is I put a big section in the middle for you. It says context. And so whenever you read the passage, you can write what context is being written there or being talked about there. Then there's three columns. And the question is prophecy, declarative, or don't know. Because the fact of the matter is sometimes the words used, you just flat out don't know if they're predicting something or if they're just declaring something. You don't know. But here's what I found. Whenever you do that study, less than 12% of the time are the words prophecy, prophesy, and to prophesy used in conjunction with prediction. Not the word, the concept. So that means over 88% of the time in the Bible, when it says the word prophecy, prophesy, or to prophesy, it's not talking about a prediction at all. Do you hear that stat? But how do we define prophecy? We define it as the less than 12%. Now, I'm not up here standing up here saying that there is no prophecy in the Bible that is a prediction. That's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying that. I'm admitting at least less than 12% of the time it is talking about that. However, if the overwhelming majority of the time is not talking about prediction, what should be the overwhelming majority of my definition of prophecy? Not prediction. You see my problem? In other words, once again, I'm asking the question, how is the Bible defining this? And if I look up every single time the word's used, and 88% of the time it's not, are you following me? If it's not talking about prediction, then maybe I need to alter my definition. Or maybe I need to broaden it. And make prediction where it needs to rightfully be, and that's secondary in prophecy. A side note. A rare occurrence. Okay? Let's keep developing this. What I believe prophecy is, revealed through the Bible, is this. Prophecy is a revelation. Now, I know that's a vague word. But it's a revelation about three things. Number one, it is about who God is. It also reveals what God desires. And the third thing that it reveals is what God demands from us. So whenever you see a prophecy, these three elements are going to be in there somewhere. Because this is the main purpose of what a prophecy is to do. It is to reveal to us who God is, what God desires, and what God demands from us. Now, I'm not going to simply just state this and not show it to you. I want to show it to you by using one of the really, really impressive predictions in the Bible. Daniel chapter 2 and Daniel chapter 7. There's this fancy chart I got from Larry Pachauer. He's a professor at Ozark Christian College. And what it does is it pictorially shows what happens in Daniel 2 and Daniel 7. If you see right over here, this is Daniel chapter 2. Do you guys remember what happens in Daniel chapter 2? Anybody? Yes.
Nebuchadnezzar has a dream.
You see, in our culture, dreams don't mean much. We think, well, it was just indigestion, or I went to sleep watching a murder movie, and that, you know, they don't mean much to us. But in their culture, and as a matter of fact, in cultures overseas today, dreams mean a lot. This is the reason why they would pour so much money into the offices of soothsayers and magicians and wise men in the Old Testament. You see those talked about a lot. It's because for them, the dreams were the playgrounds of the gods. And they wanted to ensure that if the gods had a message to give to them, that they would receive it. So, Nebuchadnezzar has one of these dreams, and it overwhelms him to the point where he is not going to be duped. He calls in his soothsayers and he says, okay, here's my proposition. You're going to tell me what the dream is before I even tell you, and then I'll listen to your interpretation. And they're freaking out. They're like, that can't happen. There's no way. And he's like, well, that's the way it's going to be. And if you can't do it, I'm going to put your houses into rubble and I'm going to cut you into pieces. And they're like, well, there's just no way. And he says, fine, then you're going to die. So Arioch, the chief general of the Babylonian army, goes to Daniel and he's going to escort him off so that he can be killed. And Daniel's like, hey, just let me go talk to the king. And Arioch's like, fine, it's your head, go ahead. He goes into Nebuchadnezzar, and Daniel says, hey, just give me some time. Nebuchadnezzar says, that's fine, but the rules don't change for you. They don't change. You have to tell me the dream and tell me the interpretation. Daniel says, fine. Calls together a prayer meeting of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. They pray. God reveals it to him. And what God reveals to him is this picture. See, because what Nebuchadnezzar had, he had this dream, and it was a dream of a statue. But the statue was separated into four different sections of four different metals. You had the top, which was the head of gold, which represented Babylon. You had the chest and arms that was silver, and that represented Medo-Persia. You had the belly and the thighs that was bronze, and that represented the Greek Empire. And then you had the legs and the feet that were mixed with iron and clay, and that represented the Roman Empire. Okay, now I know that's a lot of stuff thrown at you, but hang with me. Because it's interesting, because this very same vision is delivered to Daniel in chapter 7, but with a twist. See, because instead of having this statue with four different sections, he sees four beasts emerging from a sea. And the first beast is this, it's this lion-eagle hybrid. And the second, which corresponds to the head of gold, okay, Babylon. You follow me so far? The second beast that he sees is this lopsided bear that's chewing on three ribs and is told to go eat its fill of the flesh. That's just what it says. I'm not making this up. And that corresponds to the chest and arms of silver or Medo-Persia. Now hang with me. There's going to be a point to this. The third beast he sees is this hybrid between a cheetah. Is that right? Cheetah?
Leopard.
Thank you. I knew it was one of those spotted ones. A leopard and a bird. And this one represents or correlates to the belly and the thighs made of bronze or the Greek Empire. And the final beast is so grotesque that it cannot even be compared to anything in creation. It is just called this terrifying, grotesque, evil beast. And this correlates to the legs and the feet made of iron and clay mixed. Now, I don't want you to miss the magnificence of what God is doing here. I don't want you to miss it. See, because God is revealing something about who He is, about what He desires, about what He demands from us. But first of all, I want you to catch the magnificence of the prediction. Because if you notice, this is spans from Babylon to Rome. Do you know how many years that is? You see, Nebuchadnezzar gets this dream at around 605. That's when Babylon is starting to really reign. But Medo-Persia, the second section, does not come on the scene until 539, whenever Babylon falls. You're talking about 70 years. That's pretty impressive. But what Medo-Persia, though, reigns until around 334 or 331, whenever Greek takes over. You see the magnificence? That's a couple hundred years. And then the Greek Empire would reign until around the 1st century BC, when Rome would take over. And then they would reign for another about 400 or 500 years. So what God, in essence, has done is in 605 BC, He reveals what's going to happen in the next 600 years or more. Now that is a prediction, isn't it? The amazing thing about it is that's what actually happens. You can flip open a history book and it says the same thing. It's a fascinating prediction. But if we only stop with the prediction, then it's only God showing or flexing His divine muscle. It doesn't really mean anything except for the fact that God can tell the future. You see the problem with that? We'll get into that more in a little bit. What I think that this does is this. It reveals, number one, who God is. Who is God? He is the all-powerful, sovereign ruler over all of history. That's who it reveals that He is. He is the all-powerful, sovereign ruler over history. How do I know this? Well, number one, He can accurately pinpoint what's going to happen at least 600 years or more ahead. That's impressive. But merely information doesn't constitute sovereignty. There also needs to be an element of orchestration. You following me? And it's fascinating because if you read in Daniel 7, there's this underlying force that's moving all... It's moving beast to beast. Let me give you an example. The first beast, the lion/bird beast, it has its wings ripped off. And my question is, by whom? Who ripped them off? It's then said that the beast is stood up on its two legs. My question is, by whom? Who stood him up? It's then told that the beast is given a heart, like a heart of man. And once again, my question is, by whom? Who gave him the heart? The second beast, who is the lopsided bear chewing on some ribs, is told to go eat its fill of the flesh. And my question is, by whom? Who told that bear to go and eat its fill of the flesh? You see, Daniel's telling us something. He's saying that even though all of history looks as if the world is writing the annals and our chronicles, in reality, it is the all-powerful, sovereign God over all of history. See, His prediction is actually revealing who God is. But there's an interesting also little caveat, is He also shows us what God desires. And this comes in Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 through 14. This is a beautiful Old Testament passage. If you don't have this memorized, you need to. Daniel chapter 7, verses 13 through 14 says this. This is Daniel speaking. He says, "In my vision at night, I looked, and there before me was a one like a son of man, and he was coming with the clouds of heaven. He approached the Ancient of Days and was led into His presence. And He was given authority, glory, and sovereign power. All peoples, nations, and men of every language worshipped Him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion that will not pass away, and His kingdom is one that will never be destroyed." Now I'm going to make a suggestion here, and I'm going to prove it through Revelation chapter 1. is that this one like the Son of Man here in Daniel 7 is Jesus. This is why this passage is so fascinating to me, because we're in the Old Testament. But this is Jesus, and here's how I want to show it to you. Turn to Revelation chapter 1. I know I'm going through this quickly, but... Sorry. By the tape, I don't know what to tell you. Verse 7 says this. Now we're going to build the case step by step. Verse 7 of Revelation chapter 1 says, "Look, He is coming with the clouds." Now that is an interesting phrase, because how was it that the Son of Man in chapter 13 or in verse 13 was coming in Daniel 7? What's that? Coming with the clouds. Now I know that's not very, very impressive yet, but let's skip down to verse 12. John's speaking here and he says, "I turned around to see the voice," which that's interesting. How do you see a voice? But "I turned around to see the voice that was speaking to me. And when I turned, I saw seven golden lampstands, and among the lampstands was someone like a Son of Man." Have we heard that phrase before? Where? Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 through 14. "He is dressed in a robe reaching down to his feet, and with a golden sash around his chest. His head and hair were white like wool." Listen to this. "His head and hair were white like wool, as white as snow, and his eyes were like blazing fire." Now flip back to Daniel chapter 7. First of all, with the coming of the clouds, that's interesting, because that's not a very, very commonly used phrase. But then you have him refer to him as one like a Son of Man. That's interesting, because it seems like he's pulling from something. But look in verse 9 of Daniel chapter 7. Verse 9 of Daniel chapter 7 says this, "As I looked, thrones were set in place, and the Ancient of Days took His seat. His clothing was as white as snow. The hair of His head was white like wool, and His throne was flaming with fire, and its wheels were all ablaze." Here's what I think is happening. You see, John on Patmos sees the cosmic Christ. It's the same cosmic Christ that I'm suggesting that Daniel chapter 7 saw, but there's a twist. Because in Daniel chapter 7, it is the Ancient of Days who is as white as snow, who has hair white like wool, and who has sitting on a throne of blazing fire. But in Revelation chapter 1, it is Jesus who has hair white like wool, looks as white as snow, and in His eyes is flickering the fire of the Ancient of Days' throne. Do you see what John's doing? How did this happen? Well, it happened on a cross and an empty tomb. You see, because at the cross and the empty tomb, a kingdom was established. What was Jesus' message whenever He came to the earth? For one of the first things He says, "Repent, for the kingdom of God is near." And what I think John is showing, because if you notice in Daniel chapter 7, verse 13 through 14, what happens to the one like a Son of Man there? He receives dominion and power, and His kingdom will last forever and ever, and He builds it and builds it. And what John is saying is this, it's here. Look at Him if you don't believe me. Do you see the power of what He's developing? What I think John's suggesting with this prediction is this. Who is God? He is the all-powerful, sovereign ruler of all history. What does He desire? The climax of history, which is the kingdom. Namely, the coming of His Messiah. You see, we'll talk about this later, but I want to talk about it now. Yes. Yes.
Well, I mean, I believe everything that we believe.
Mm-hmm.
But how well schooled was... I mean, weren't they well schooled in the Old Testament scripture?
Yes.
Okay, so mm-hmm. Wouldn't he already have some of this knowledge of...
Who?
John.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, so to me, he could be... repeating what he was taught.
Okay, but we have in Revelation chapter 1, he's saying he received these visions while standing on the island of Patmos. It's not necessarily revealing total new things to John, but you have to realize John's plight at this time. I mean, he's on an island banished away from the churches he's been pastoring, and the church, he's the last apostle living. It doesn't look good for the church. Because the last apostle is about to die. And what I think Revelation's doing is it's delivering a message of hope, reiterating and reestablishing what they know about who God is. But I mean, the reality is this. When you go through things in your life, isn't it hard to keep in perspective who God is? I mean, isn't it? Whenever Sarah and I had our miscarriage 2 summers ago, it was very hard for me to say that God is a sovereign, all-powerful ruler. It was difficult for me. But it doesn't mean it wasn't true. And it doesn't mean I didn't know that. It just means I had to be reminded of that. I had to have it re-revealed to me. And so I think that's part of what Revelation is doing. But what I think John does here also is he's in case people are missing it, he wants to show that what is talked about in the Old Testament has come to its fruition in Christ in the church. And that's why these, matter of fact, we'll talk about this in a couple of weeks, but in 404 verses of Revelation, there's over 500 allusions to the Old Testament. They knew their Old Testament. But the beauty of it is whenever you see the interconnectedness of what John's doing in Revelation, is you see how God has developed His salvation history throughout all of the pages of the Bible, and not just the New Testament. Jesus is in the Old Testament. I'm not saying look for Him under every rock, but whenever it's pretty obvious, let Him be there. That's what I'm saying. So yeah, John would have known this, but they would have needed reminded. They would have needed reminded. That's my take on it anyway. But I know we have one more element, do we not? We know what the prediction of Daniel is saying who God is, and I think that we even know what he's saying, what God desires, the climax of history or the kingdom being established through His Messiah. But there's the third element of what God demands of us, and after this one we'll take about a 5-minute break. What God demands of us makes Daniel freak out. Because in Daniel chapter 7, verse 28, he says, I turned pale, and I was disturbed to my core. And then he says, but I just didn't tell anybody about it. And the first time I read it, I was like, no, that doesn't make any sense to me at all. Because I was just told that the kingdom was going to be established to reign forever and ever and ever and ever and ever. And then you say, I turned pale. I was deeply distressed. The reason why is because, you see, Daniel understands the way the kingdom attains victory. Because if you notice, you go from Babylon down to the first beast, down to the fourth beast. And the fourth beast is so grotesque and evil that it can't even be parallel to anything in creation. And what God is saying to Daniel is this. Yeah, Babylon's bad, but it's going to get worse. It's going to get a lot worse. It's going to get so worse, I can't even describe it. I mean, I can talk about how this beast has teeth like iron because it is so vicious that all the other three beasts combined maybe will match how mean and vicious this beast is. It's a nasty one. And Daniel's going, come again? I'm sorry, what? If you're the sovereign ruler, then what is happening? Why is it in Daniel chapter 7, verse 21, does it say that God's people, the saints, will be handed over and be delivered into oppression? Matter of fact, 7:25 of Daniel actually even more specifically says, God delivers the saints over to the oppressive agents. You see, because what the cross teaches us is that in the kingdom of God, the way we attain victory is through suffering. And that is not something that we like to hear. And that is not something that Daniel liked to hear. It's going to get worse. But that is the beautiful reality about the kingdom that we are in. Is that we do not have to punch someone when they punch us. We can turn the other cheek because in the kingdom of God, we attain victory through suffering. And like I said, the cross teaches us that. Christ, the true Israel, taught the church, the new Israel, that we attain victory through suffering. Does that make sense? I know wanting to look at passages like Revelation 17:6 when it talks about the harlot on the beast that is drunk on the blood of the saints. I know how passages like that make my blood boil. Because the bottom line is that I just want to be kept safe and comforted. I just want to be raptured out of here before anything bad happens. Here's my problem. That's not what we're promised throughout the entire Bible, especially the New Testament. That's not what we're promised. What does Jesus say promised to us? If you follow me, what are you going to have to do? Pick up your cross, then come follow me. Blessed are those that are persecuted because of me. What does John talk about? Paul, in all of his letters. I know how you have been suffering, but consider yourself worthy to suffer for the sake of Christ. What is it that is constantly through the books of the Bible that we ignore? It's suffering. And this is a concept in America that is so hard for us to understand, but this is what is being revealed. Now here's my question. If I boiled this down to just a prediction, how much of the message would we miss? See my problem? And how do you obey a prediction? I don't know. Like for instance, if I said the lottery numbers in the next 2 weeks or whenever it is are going to be this, 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 and this. Obey it. How do I obey a number that you told me was going to happen? But it's interesting because Revelation chapter 1 verse 3 says, "Blessed are those that hear the words of this prophecy and obey them." Here's what I'm suggesting. Prophecy in the Bible is not about prediction. It is about a revelation. It is about a revelation of who God is, what God desires, and what God demands of us. If prediction is used, it is simply used as an agent to get this message across. Matter of fact, D.B. Sandy in his book, Plowshares and Pruning Hooks, says that the function of a prophecy is to make the prosecution and the persuasion more convincing. In other words, prediction's just a vehicle to get the real message across. And if you stop at the prediction, you're going to miss the message. And this is the definition I'm suggesting that we need to come to the book of Revelation with. Does that make sense? Okay, you guys get 5 minutes. Oh, that's 2 minutes fast. Beautiful. You guys get 5 minutes, and we'll come back, and I'm going to start at 8:04 on the dot.